Kevin Knapp is editor and co-owner of the Washington Blade, the oldest LGBTQI plus newspaper in the United States, founded in 1969. His first book, How We Won the War for LGBTQ Equality and How Our Enemies Could Take It All Away, I love that title, is available now. Thank you for joining us, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
You joined The Blade in 2002. For those who may not be familiar with the publication, tell us about the newspaper's long and impressive history.
Sure. The Blade was founded, as you said, right after Stonewall in 1969, and has published ever since. We're the nation's oldest LGBTQ newspaper, and we're the only queer outlet that's in the White House briefing room and in the president's pool rotation and so forth. So that's kind of our, I guess, claim to fame. But The Blade covers all sorts of topics, not just politics. We cover pop culture and the arts. And so there's a lot in the book that is political, but there's also a lot that is a little more dishy and fun.
That's great. So you know, 2002 was kind of the internet explosion. Talk about the impact on the Washington Blade and how the publication survived and thrived while many others didn't.
Well, I think it's a number of things, really. I mean, we're, first of all, you know, smaller niche media outlets can be more nimble and, you know, weren't sort of dragged down by a lot of the legacy costs that the big metropolitan daily, you know, papers had, pensions and real estate and so forth. So, you know, I think smaller outlets had an advantage from that perspective. And in terms of The Blade specifically, we've always worked hard to diversify our revenue streams. And so it's never, for us, it's never been about, you know, preserving print advertising, though we still do publish in print. We've always been focused on digital products, on our events business. We have a nonprofit arm. We've launched other businesses, including the Los Angeles Blade, which just celebrated its sixth anniversary. So for us, it's always been about staying nimble and you know, throwing everything at the wall and see what sticks, because that's basically what the big metro papers have been doing in a bigger way. You know, I don't pretend to have the answers to where publishing goes, but I don't think the New York Times publisher has those answers or the CEO of Google either. So we're doing what we, you know, need to do to stay relevant and competitive and to keep thriving.
When you became co-owner, what changes did you bring about, if any, at that time?
Well, responsible fiscal management. For one, I think we stopped living beyond our means and taking millions of dollars in SBA loans. So, I think being, you know, fiscally responsible, doubling down on, you know, our local focus and coverage, because while we are known most probably for our, you know, national political coverage, we do have a robust print edition in the market still. And those readers want to hear local news, local arts. So making sure that that we're delivering for those folks as well as for our national readers.
How many newspapers are you still distributing?
In print, I think we're still around 15,000 a week.
Oh, that's a lot.
In print, yeah.
Yeah. What was it at the height, sort of before the internet? About the same, yeah. Or?
No, it's probably come down. I would say, I don't know, 20 or 25,000 maybe at the height.
All right. Well, not a huge change. I mean, 15,000 yeah. is still a nice big number.
Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about the decision to head west and start the Los Angeles Blade.
Well, that was really precipitated by the closure of Frontiers, which operated there for about 30 years or so and was a really good publication. You know, they did good journalism at Frontiers for a long time. And then I don't remember the history of it all, but it changed ownership and it just kind of fell apart and eventually closed. And I had always wanted to work with Karen Oakham, who was the news editor at Frontiers. And she's a fantastic queer journalist. And Troy Masters reached out to us about collaborating on something, and it all just kind of came together. And Troy and Karen were the publisher and the editor at the outset, and just did phenomenal work, you know, getting things going. And we supported them with all the back office and everything we can do from DC. It makes for a great excuse to go to LA in February. So
when you really need to get away.
Then,
what's the staff at LA in LA, and what's the staff the numbers of in Washington?
Oh gosh, I haven't counted lately. I think we're about 15 full-time employees. And then, you know, there are part-timers and lots of freelancers. So it's a good group. We also have a really robust fellowship program that I've been working on actually this morning, picking our summer fellows. Those are run out of our nonprofit Blade Foundation, and people can contribute money, and it goes to funding fellowships for aspiring queer journalists. And it's been a really great success. The future is bright when it comes to queer journalism. I'm happy to say.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Because there's a lot of fake news out there, and it's difficult to sort of sift through the garbage. Your writers are amazing. I'm checking out The Blade 2-3 times a day. So, talk about the struggle to get into the White House press briefing room.
Oh gosh, that's a long, that's a long struggle. I mean, that goes back to the Reagan administration when we were admitted to the Blade was admitted, Lou Chabarro, who still is with us. He was admitted to the briefing room, but was, you know, stuck in the back, and they never took his questions, of course. And I don't know, that went on for a long time. And it wasn't until, probably George W. Bush's presidency that we had a little bit more of a presence, and we started getting some questions in, and it slowly evolved. Obviously, things were better during the Obama years, and where we are now, it's pretty amazing. We now have a dedicated seat in the briefing room, so we're the only LGBTQ alternative outlet that has that. That was hard fought for, and a lot of journalists over a lot of years worked a lot of hours to get us to this point. So it's an honor to have that, and one of the things that I think distinguishes us.
Absolutely, and how incredible is it that we have an out lesbian doing that briefing.
Yes. That is another first.
Yeah. So you've been recognized by the Society of Professional Journalists for your editorial writing. Talk about how you tackle an opinion piece that covers a controversial topic.
Well, I talk in the book about what motivates me, and it's very similar to what motivated Larry Kramer, which is anger. So a lot of my essays over the years were motivated by anger and frustration. My original title for the book was Ranting Toward Equality, and everyone hated it. The editor, the publisher, everybody hated it because it was too mean, too aggressive. But that was my preferred title, and it sort of captured what I've been doing for, I think, 20 years now. So that's usually where the idea comes from, reading our own coverage and original reporting, and, you know, something outrageous happens that upsets me, and then I kind of get to work.
Great. And talk about some of the topics that were particularly challenging for you to write about.
Oh, gosh. I think writing about the politics and, for example, you know, like the marriage fight, that stuff comes pretty easily to me. The stuff that's hard to write about, I think, is the personal stuff. So this book is not a memoir, and I did not want to write a memoir, and I did not want to write a, you know, overwrought coming out story. And that's not what this is. So I think writing about personal things, personal issues is the hardest for me, at least. So, you know, writing about my own marriage, there's an essay in the book about I was in a really bad car accident right before we were going to get married and kind of what that did to our planning and so forth. So I would say, you know, anything personal is what I would prefer to not write about.
And also when you said personal, I think, you know, it was just a trans day of remembrance and you know, chatting with young people and the way that they identify and how different they are from, you know, a 60-year-old white gay man, their experiences. Talk about the complexity of the coverage of, you know, the intersex community, the asexual community, you know, queer questioning community, on and on and on, and even the trans community, being careful not to misgender folks and really understanding how they want to be identified as far as gender and sexuality.
Sure. Well, it's interesting. I mean, none of it bothers me because, you know, I have a brain, and if someone tells me I use they, them pronouns, I can remember that, and then I can just address them that way. I don't really get all of the, you know, frustration and anger and pushback around this whole issue. It's just a matter of respect and courtesy that somebody tells you that they identify in a way that may not be obvious to you, and then you can just remember that and call them that. So I don't really get all of the hoopla over this issue. I will say, and what I've told, I've been touring around a little bit, a couple of college campuses in the last few weeks, and I find, first of all, I'm very optimistic about Gen Z. Their voting patterns are strong. They are stronger than the millennials. They're engaged in a way that their predecessors just weren't. And I think that what has really united them as a generation is growing up with all these mass shootings. And, you know, I never had a active shooter drill in school, and I'm sure you didn't either. But these kids have been doing that since kindergarten. And I think the long-term, you know, impact of growing up like that has compelled them to become active at a younger age, not just by voting, but by protesting. And, you know, when you look at what happened in Tennessee 2 weeks ago, you know, all of that was driven by Gen Z. Maxwell Frost, we just did a big cover story with him, an amazing voice for that generation and typical of sort of the outlook that they have. So I'm very optimistic about the future of our movement and about this generation in particular. And the recurring question I keep getting at college events, there's a lot of apprehension and the big question is, what does the next 5 years look like? What's going to happen in the next 5 years? So I think, you know, I think that generation is rightly nervous about all that's happening. And that speaks to the second part of my book's title, which is how our enemies could take it all away. When we came up with that title, that was before all of these bills came down this year targeting trans youth and drag queens now. And I don't know about you, but I know some drag queens. I don't know if you know any. I know drag queens, okay? Literally the last people in the world I would pick a fight with is drag queens. Like, this is not going to end well for Republicans. So, anyway, there's a lot of apprehension, I think, in that generation, and they're right to feel that way, because I think it is going to get worse before it, you know, returns, before the pendulum swings back our way again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to me, it's all about backlash. I mean, it's the culture war, but that white heterosexual, you know, middle class, lower class male feels because of, you know, propaganda TV, fake news, wacko websites, wacko tweets, that they're losing something. They're losing something to someone else, and that's making them crazy.
Right. Right. And Republicans, they've been creative in how they exploit these prejudices. You know, they know, for example, the reason that the trans community is now the target of all this stuff is that they see the polls, the same polls that we see, which is that attacks on marriage equality, for example, don't work anymore. Attacks on queer service members, you know, those attacks do not resonate with independent suburban voters who decide elections. And so they've moved on and to the trans community, and the way they frame it and the way Glenn Youngkin did in his Virginia gubernatorial race was not so much to come out and say, you know, trans people are horrible and you know, we should lock them up or something. It's to frame it all as a parental rights thing. Like, sure, parents should have a right to have influence over the curriculum at their kids' school. And of course, parents should have a say in what books are in the libraries, you know, and that messaging resonated in Florida and Virginia, and it will be nationalized in 2024.
With the underlying hate and the right. underlying fear mongering about grooming and
right.
yeah, they're, you know, yeah. It's recruitment week for the LGBT community. Lock up your kids.
Exactly.
So as an editor, what are the sort of three topics or issues that you're really keeping an eye on a daily, maybe hourly basis?
Well, I think the main focus is going to be in the state houses, the state legislatures now, because with divided government at the federal level, there's just nothing happening. You know, the Equality Act, which we still need to pass, it was passed in the House and then it died in the Senate. And of course, with McCarthy in charge now, it's not going to go anywhere in the next 2 years. So, and, you know, with the Supreme Court doing what it's doing, nothing good's going to come out of that either. So I think the focus is on state houses, state battles. You know, the movement, for better or worse, I think relied a lot and perhaps too much on the courts for our victories in the last 20 years. And so it's going to require a real change in focus and strategy to say, all right, we're taking it on the chin in the courts. We need to go back to the legislatures, and you know, that can be a lot more time consuming, you know, cultivating allies in state houses in conservative places is not easy work, but I think that's where, you know, the action is going to be. So that's number one. And I think number two is just, you know, keeping an eye on the Supreme Court. They've already overturned Roe, and everyone expects an attack on Obergefell. They have the votes to overturn that if they choose to, if the right case makes it up there. So and then, you know, there are questions about Lawrence. Does the Lawrence decision remain intact, or will they go after privacy rights? You know, the Republicans claim to want government out of our lives until it's queer lives that we're talking about, and then they want to be in the bedrooms and the libraries and the drag clubs and wherever else we are. So I fear it's going to be some dark days ahead. And then of course the third thing would just be the 2024 race, and because a lot will hinge on, of course, that. Unfortunately, I think we already lost the most critical race of recent history, which was the 2016 race. Giving Trump 3 Supreme Court picks was an epic disaster. And if you know, but for 70,000 votes spread across a few swing states, Hillary Clinton would have appointed those 3 justices, and the whole world would look very different right now.
You know, your book is sort of a call to action. What are the three things that our listeners can do after listening to the show and reading your book?
Vote. Number one is vote. If you do nothing else, that is the one thing you have to do. And it's funny, you know, when I get that question from college campuses, and when you tell young people, Gen Z, to vote, they're kind of like, yeah, okay, what else? What else? That's not enough. And it actually is enough, but we welcome more. But at the very least, vote. I think staying informed, making an effort to stay informed as a voter, that's becoming increasingly hard to do these days with news deserts and with, you know, algorithms kind of dictating what sort of information we're fed on social media. You really do have to make, I think, an effort to seek out sources of information and diversify your news diet so that you are going into that voting booth an informed citizen. So that's two things: be informed, vote, and then you wanted a third thing. I think it's really important to be more than an ally to the community and to other communities. And we talked a lot about intersectionality as it's become something of a buzzword, but I like to remind the folks who look like us, the cisgender gay white, the polling around that issue didn't shift until we started featuring Black pastors and the Black churches in our ads, until the immigration rights groups and the labor unions started to march with us. That's when the needle moved and minds were changed. And so it's important for us to remember those that were there for us, and we need to be there for them. So I think it's important, whatever you are, if you're a straight person who identifies as an ally, step it up and be an accomplice instead of an ally. Get involved, march in the streets, go to a Trans Day of Remembrance vigil, you know, be informed and write your lawmakers and all of those things. So that's what I would say. Be a good citizen, an ally, an accomplice, vote and be informed.
And support your local newspapers, you know, the news agencies that matter to you, queer news outlets. They need your money, they need your support. I can't remember a time. I mean, you know, Reagan sort of touched on this in the 80s about the media, but you know, it's been decades since there was this attack on the media.
Yeah. Yeah, and not just queer media, but I would say, you know, embrace the Black press. There's some really great work being done in the Black press right now. There's still a good number of robust Black-run publications all over the country. And then, you know, there's Hispanic press, Jewish press, there's homeless press. I encourage people to seek out all of those kinds of outlets, because you're right, they do need support. They get overlooked, they get taken for granted. And you know, we're in this era of sort of cable dominance and everything is nationalized. But what people really should want to read about and follow is what's happening in their own communities. And so you need to make an effort to seek those out.
Yes, yes. Go to city council meetings when your House of Representative. Has a meeting, go to it, go to their website, get the emails from them. I mean, I so appreciate hearing from Mike Thompson here in California on a weekly basis. I'm not annoyed. I want to know what he's doing. Yeah, you don't need to feel obligated to give money, but it's great if you can. But really getting involved at the grassroots level is a great thing to do. I love that in your title you sort of mention enemies. I mean, you know, the rant title I loved. But I, you know, as negative as it sounds, you sort of have to identify who your enemies are and how you can deal with them, how you can stop them, or how you can inform them. You know, you just don't need to call your representative. I've heard other senators from other states say, I appreciate calls from all over the country because, you know, my state may be a small state and maybe a big state. You know, I want to know what everyone's thinking. There was a question in there somewhere and I lost it. But talk about the decision to sort of include that concept that we as the queer community, we have enemies who will do us harm.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the first part of the title, what that really refers to is how we won the war for LGBTQ equality. That refers to when I started at the Blade 20 years ago, the movement had sort of outlined four big goals for itself. So it was getting sexual orientation and gender identity added to the federal hate crimes law. It was overturning Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It was getting some form of relationship recognition. Nobody was talking marriage equality back then. It was civil unions or civil partnerships or something. And then the other one was workplace protections. So the Employment Non-Discrimination Act was the bill at the time. It's now been turned into the Equality Act and it still can't pass. And when you look at those four goals and the 20 years that passed since then, we really achieved most of that. I mean, we overturned Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We got marriage equality in all 50 states. We got the hate crimes law updated. And while we didn't get the Equality Act done, the Bostock Supreme Court ruling really did extend workplace protections to the vast majority of LGBTQ workers. And people should be aware of that. You know, in states even where you're not protected or local jurisdictions, that Supreme Court decision extends to most workers. There are a couple of holes. It doesn't apply to small businesses with fewer than 15 employees. It doesn't apply to religious institutions. And it doesn't impact areas like credit and public accommodations and jury service. But the vast majority of workers in America are covered by that ruling. So we really did achieve most of what we set out to do 20 years ago. And we went from a president, George Bush, who I would argue was worse than Trump. He was terrible and he ran his reelection on the backs of our relationships. And the whole campaign was run by a closeted gay guy, Ken Melman. We went from that and we went from George W. Bush calling for a federal constitutional amendment banning gay marriage in the State of the Union address. We went from that to now, 20 years later, we have a president who has said trans rights are the civil rights issue of our time. I mean, so we could not have, I mean, no one could have foreseen 20 years ago how far we would come in such a short period of time. So that's what the first part of the title of the book refers to. We really did in many respects win the war. And not just on policy, but in terms of visibility and acceptance. I mean, 20 years ago, everybody was in the closet, right? Anderson Cooper, everybody. There were very few of any out figures in the media, in Hollywood and so forth. And now you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a gay pop star or anchor person or whatever. So that's the first part of the title. The second part about our enemies is what we're seeing unfold right now. You know, it's backlash, but it's not. I just encourage people to, you know, not think of it as sort of spontaneous or knee-jerk backlash. It is well-organized, well-funded opposition with these right-wing groups, and they are very skilled at what they do. And again, these enemies are real. They are well-funded, and when you look at what they did on abortion, they wanted to get rid of. People thought they wanted to get rid of Roe. They don't. That's not really their goal. They want a national ban on all abortion. That's the real goal. And so now you're seeing this fight over the abortion pill. This is absolutely what's next. And you saw what Idaho did a couple of weeks ago, banning taking women across state lines for an abortion, you know, procuring abortion pills for people's illegal now there. And so when they shift their focus to us, and it's coming, Obergefell, the marriage ruling, is absolutely top of their list. We've already had Alito and Thomas both have publicly called for revisiting that decision. And when you add their votes to the three Trump picks, there's the five you need to overturn Obergefell. So I do think the movement needs to be prepared for that. I think it will probably happen. And we will go back to a patchwork of laws again. And again, when I was talking about state houses, the importance of those now, not to wait, but to work now, because there are so many states that still have marriage bans and other laws on the books. Sodomy laws are still on the books. Maryland just repealed its sodomy law last week. Mm. Maryland, which is like the bluest of blue states, and with Democratic solid majorities in both houses and a Democratic governor, it took them all this time just to repeal an unconstitutional sodomy law in Maryland. So those laws are still on the books. So if Lawrence goes down, those state sodomy laws would come back into effect. Mm. We would be criminalized. And people don't realize this. That Lawrence case was about a gay couple having sex in their private home with the doors locked, and angry ex-boyfriend of one of the guys filed a false police report that there was an intruder in the house with a gun. The cops show up, knock the door down, and find this gay couple in bed having sex and arrest them under the Texas sodomy law. It took a 2003 court decision to establish our right to private sex. That is insane. And that's what's coming back if we're not careful and if we're not paying attention, because our enemies are paying attention. And we need to be working now to unravel all of these old laws that people just forgot about because they're not relevant anymore because of the Supreme Court rulings. But if those rulings are overturned, those old laws will come back into effect. Mm.
And maybe the last question or so, how do you cover, you know, a gay Republican like George Santos, and how do you bring yourself to cover log cabin gay Republicans? How newsworthy are they? I know some sites sort of just ignore them, try to ignore them. I mean, log cabin Republicans, I think they've really sort of lost their luster, but they're still out there.
Well, they are out there, and I think it's a mistake to dismiss them. I've always had a really good working relationship with Log Cabin. They've had some really smart, good leaders, and, you know, I may disagree with them on policy, but we were always able to work together when needed. We always were cordial to one another and professional and respectful. And where that all fell apart for me, anyway, was the last election, the 2020 election. Because 2016, Log Cabin declined to endorse Trump. And in 2020, they did endorse him. And not only did they endorse him, but they've been doing events at Mar-a-Lago. They've been doing events at the old Trump Hotel in Washington. And, you know, imagine the outcry from Log Cabin if Barack Obama had owned a hotel and HRC was holding its fundraising events there. You know, they would rightly lose their minds, but yet they see nothing wrong with doing the very same thing themselves. And so I have fallen out with Log Cabin over that. Mm. I just think there's no way that anyone could endorse that president for reelection after all that he did. And we don't even need to go into it because we all know the laundry list of horrible things he did. How anyone with any credibility could endorse him for president, I mean, it's insane. The problem is when you look at the exit polls that were done in the last two elections, Trump's share of the gay vote went up from 2016 to 2020. Yes, it went up a lot. I forget. I think it was around 16% in 2016, and in like 23% or something in 2020. So he got nearly a quarter of the gay vote, and it doesn't include trans. I think it's just gay, lesbian, bisexual that they track. But that's a lot. I mean, that's almost a quarter of our community supporting Trump, even after all of the terrible things that he did and all of the, you know, the Supreme Court picks. So I think it's a mistake to ignore them. I think we need to engage with them. I don't know that we can engage with Log Cabin anymore because they've gone over the MAGA cliff, and they're still holding events at Mar-a-Lago just recently. And in fact, there was a Log Cabin chapter, I think in San Antonio, that organized a protest against drag queens, of all things. So we're you know, these people are traitors to our community. They are MAGA crazy. They are not rational people that you can reason with. So I just walk away from them. But I think we do need to engage with the other voters out there in our own community who still, you know, respect facts and play within the sandbox of reason and logic to explain why some of these Republicans are so dangerous for our community's future.
And I think your point is, you know, we again, I speak for myself, I feel privileged being a white man, even a white gay man, and really trying to acknowledge and join the struggle that other sort of underserved minority groups, whatever term is sort of PC right now, to understand, you know, the people are still learning from what ACT UP did, and people are still learning from, you know, the suffragette movement. You know, these struggles will continue, and looking back at how they were achieved, you know, how marriage equality was achieved was sort of knocking on doors and talking to your grandmother and saying, I'm gay, or, you know, what we should be able to get married like you.
Yeah, I mean, my big hope for this book was, honestly, I wanted to kind of preserve the work, but also I wanted to leave a blueprint so younger generations can pick this up and they can see, you know, in one concise place sort of how, you know, our generation chose to fight back. Here's what we did. Here's what worked. Here's what didn't work. And because you're going to have to fight these battles again, right? They're going to fight for abortion rights again. They're going to be fighting for marriage equality again. So here's how we did it, and for better or worse, and my hope is that it can be useful to future generations as they get involved in fighting back, and so that's kind of the motivation really for the whole book, was to preserve this, you know, in one place, and the reality, of course, for this generation of young people is that if they don't take it upon themselves to read books, they're never going to learn about our community because it's not taught in schools. We're invisible in school curricula, and it's getting worse because places like Florida are now, you know, banning the mention of the word gay. I was talking to someone the other day, and this is so crazy that they're now, DeSantis is trying to expand the don't say gay through 12th grade. So if that happens, you could literally have a situation where you have, there are seniors in high school who are 18 years old, legal adults, right? You could be an 18-year-old senior in your social studies class, and you're not allowed to learn that an openly gay man almost won the Iowa caucuses in 2020 because that would be a violation of the proper anti-gay propaganda law. It's madness.
It is madness. And we live in a time when, you know, 95% of people have smartphones. So the information is there. I got this discussion with someone about libraries, because to me, the library is such an incredible source. And I found out that really only 37% of this country's population has access to a library. And, you know, the library here is, you know, free internet and services and classes, just everything. But, you know, we're literally in a time when they're banning books.
Right. And how ridiculous of these lawmakers to think that they can keep children of any age nowadays from accessing anything they want, because you can ban all the books you want in the library, but they've got a library in their back pocket and they can just Google any topic and it's all at their fingertips. So what a waste of time, and what a just an outmoded way of thinking in 2023.
And such a disservice to young people and their constituents. I mean, how that doesn't enrage people,
right?
Whatever their political background, affiliation, you're going to tell me now what I can read or what website I can look at.
Once again, you know, Republican hypocrisy, getting government out of our lives.
Exactly. We will end on that horrible note, but congratulations on the publication of your must-read book. And I really, really recommend it to all of my listeners and really just everyone. You know, the straights can learn from it. How We Won the War for LGBTQ Equality.
Yes, thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Of course. Please keep up the great work with the both Blade publications. And thank you for joining us tonight, Kevin Knapp.
Great. Awesome. Thanks so much. Take care.